it's really a privilege to kick off this event. And it's very appropriate given how I led with Rhode Island and the anecdote that Dennis gave you. It was one of many sites. It wasn't in order of ranking. I don't want you to misread what he said, that you were the number two most vulnerable and New York was number four. I was giving some anecdotal examples to help people think about differences in different places. And sea level rise will hit different places differently, and that's surprising because you think water will find its own level and probably hit everywhere the same. That was the point of some of those examples I gave. What I want to do tonight, I'm not going to show you any PowerPoint. I'm not even going to give you numbers except for maybe two or three. I'm going to keep it really simple. I want to have essentially a conversation with you. I want you to think differently about the future. And because both the other speakers this evening and tomorrow, those of you who are going to come to the all-day workshop, that really a wonderful program, are going to get lots of specifics about models and what's happening and what can we do. I want to help you see the future. And it's really appropriate, I think, to do that here in a town which is as historic as probably any town in America. When you pass the pub downtown, and I think the sign says 1673, is if I'm right. So 350 years ago, right? Something like that. And so you have living history here all around you. If we looked forward 350 years, I'll make another stark pronouncement, just like I talked about some things in the book, that there will be barriers on either side of Jamestown blocking off Narragansett Bay, and there'll be locks that boats have to go through. Because within 300 or 400 years, there is no question sea level is going to be 10 or 20 feet higher. That's astounding. It's hard to imagine. And people will come up with reasons why. Well, it's not going to be practical. It's going to hurt the sailing business. It's going to do this. I'm sure all that's true. But as New Englanders, you all are not only pragmatic and you're tenacious, you're sometimes said to be gritty, flinty, lots of adjectives, I'm sure, and you've got many more than I know about. I spent a bit of time in New England. But the fact is, ice is melting, and the sea level is rising, and the shoreline's going to move inland. And there are a few places on the planet fortunate enough to have bottlenecks in big bays where over the next several centuries we'll be able to actually preserve the shoreline that we have come to know and love and cherish and not want to lose. Now, I don't know what century we're going to build those barriers. And there are other places in the world where they're going to get to do them as well, whether it be San Francisco Bay, whether it's the Baltic. Time will tell. The reason I'm so clear about it is because the oceans have already warmed by 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And in the long term of this planet, the size of the ice sheets and glaciers changes with ocean temperature over centuries. One of the things that happens with the models that you're going to hear about this evening and tomorrow, for those that are here, is trying to fine-tune the projections of storms, sea level rise, extreme tides, and all the other events. And those things can layer on top of each other and are really important to think about separately. But sometimes when we're looking at those models and our ability to be specific and to fine-tune them and project what's going to go underwater, we miss the big picture. And so what I'd like to do is present that big picture to you here in about 20 minutes and give you time to ask questions. Any of you who just don't understand something, or even if you want to dispute whether some of the facts I've put together, I welcome that. I've been doing this for about 2 years now since my book was published. I traveled essentially all over the world. I was in Hong Kong 10 days ago talking to the Hong Kong government, who have a different kind of flooding problem. I was the keynote for the Miami, Florida Chamber of Commerce 5 days ago. They don't like this subject any more than, in fact, for them, it's a lot worse than it is here. They're 4 feet above sea level. It's porous limestone. Seawalls won't work, and there's no higher ground to move to. So different places have different vulnerability, and it's important to remember that. But there's several big concepts I'd like you to just step back and think about. Not that we know when the worst is going to happen. But sea level rise is now inevitable. We must not confuse the need to adapt to a higher sea level and a shoreline that's moving inland with our efforts to be sustainable and green and energy conservation and reduce greenhouse gases and all of those other things, which are really important. Because if we don't do those things, the rate of sea level rise could get catastrophic. I mean, to the point where we really can't adapt quickly enough. This is simple physics. The long-term correlation and geologic history, the long-term correlation of global average temperature to sea level varies 20 meters per degree Celsius or 35 feet per degree Fahrenheit, depending on which system you prefer. So 35 feet per degree Fahrenheit, we've had a degree and a half of warming. Do the math. That's 50 feet of sea level rise. Now, we don't know whether that's going to take 300 years or 3,000 years. We really don't. You'd think we would, but the models can't be that specific, and I can actually give you some answers for that perhaps seems like incompetence or inability, but it's not. But I want to let you see a new reality because I think actually your vulnerability here is an opportunity. There's no doubt that the shape of Narragansett Bay and the extensive coastline that makes you the smallest state but the ocean state makes this a topic front and center here. We all understand that. That's why you're here on a nasty night. I think you call it wicked weather or something like that up here. So looking back at the history of sea level with the ice age, it actually just helps to see what can happen without realizing how soon it can happen. But I want to just clarify that. The ice ages have been a natural cycle. We've been having ice ages for 3, 4, 5 million years on this planet, since before any of you were born. Ice ages are every 100,000 years. The last peak ice age was 20,000 years ago. Now, that seems like a long time ago. When you think about, you know, biblical times and so on, a few thousand years ago, it wasn't that long ago. In geologic history, it was yesterday. 20,000 years ago, we had 2 miles of ice across the northern hemisphere all around the planet. And I use approximate numbers, easy to remember. 2 miles of ice is 10,000 feet, right? Pretty close. 10,000 feet of ice melted over 10 or 15,000 years, raised the ocean level 390 feet straight up, got to the present level about 5,000 years ago. I mean, that's stunning. It's hard to imagine. But it's simple geologic history. There's not even any doubt about it. And it's a natural cycle. It's happened every 100,000 years, give or take 20%. Between 95 and 125,000 years is the phase of the ice age cycles. So if we look back in history, we can see historic houses and we can see how colonial times were in America. But if we look back in geologic scale history, we see that sea level changes dramatically. And we just got fooled. We didn't know enough when we started building cities up on the coast. And then, unfortunately, even though we did know the truth about the ice ages about a century ago, we just started building more and more permanent and bigger buildings on the coast. And the scientists, the geologists weren't talking to the real estate developers, I guess, or the planners. But when buildings only lasted 30 or 40 years and were maybe, you know, vacation homes that you could tear down or rebuild or something, it wasn't bad. But in the last 50 years, and most of our lifetimes, the last 50 to 60 to 80 years, we've been building these bigger and bigger and more permanent structures. Houses, office buildings, resorts, ports, power plants, LNG terminals, and things like that that don't move very easily. They don't jack up and put on a trailer. So we have a problem. Now, you have a big problem here. But I want to talk about the glass being half full as much as it's half empty, if I may. Because how we look at problems determines whether we have the initiative and the energy and the plan to move forward. And we've all seen that in all sorts of problems in our lives, in our communities, in our country, in our world. And so what I'd like to do tonight isn't so much give you lots of facts, but help you see a bigger picture, and I'll be glad to answer any challenges or questions at the end, and just talk about a few of these concepts, if you will. So one is sea level rise isn't going to stop for centuries. It can't. The ocean's 1.5 degrees warmer. The ice sheets have to get smaller. Even if we stopped all greenhouse gases today, greenhouse gases over the last 10 million years have ranged from 180 to 280 parts per million. They're now at 400 parts per million, as some of you know, and headed straight up. And that's the byproduct of burning fossil fuels. We're not going to get off fossil fuels tomorrow, but even if we could go 100% wind, solar, and nuclear tomorrow, 100%, not put another molecule of carbon dioxide in the air, sea level is still going to rise for centuries because the oceans have been warmed. That's the storage battery for the heat. So that's just the truth. You know, people say, well, do you like that? You know, doesn't that make you sad? I say, well, getting older makes me sad, okay? But I don't have any choice about that either. And it makes people laugh, but the truth is there's a good lesson there. There's some things in life we don't like. The planet has changed temperature regimes on its own. The ice age cycle, we weren't responsible for the ice age cycles. There was a natural change in climate. Changing sea level, which we geologists or other people who study these things looked at, and I did this back in college, changing sea levels is proof of long-term climate change. Because as the ice sheets and glaciers melt and go to the ocean, they're going to be reflected in sea level. We can find sea levels over a span of 600 feet vertically. So sea level proves climate change, and we can look at those natural cycles. But in our time, we've now triggered a different direction. And it becomes really clear when you look at the pattern of the last few hundred thousand years and how things are going contrary to the natural direction at the moment. We should be entering the 80,000-year cooling phase as the glaciers expand and increase and sea level slowly drops and the planet slowly gets colder until the next ice age. Well, we've solved that problem. We're not going to have another ice age to worry about. But the planet does change, and we've just never had to cope with it at this speed. But we have 7 billion people headed to 10 billion, and we need to just wake up and use that New England pragmatism. You know, and it is what it is. There's no point stewing about it. Let's get on with tomorrow and figure out what to do about it. And I'm really impressed by the collaboration here between the state agency, between the universities and the communities. Even what I've seen in the last 24 hours, I ran into Grover in New York at a meeting, the Rising Sea Summit. I've been talking to several people here from both the Coastal Resources Center and the CRMC, I guess, and I've read about your Department of Environmental Management. You really are doing great stuff. The collaboration and forward thinking and starting to talk about what happens when sea level gets to 1 feet, 3 feet, and 5 feet is fantastic. Very few communities are being that progressive. Another concept I want you to think about is one of the reasons this is so challenging is that sea level is just one form of flooding, and it's the one we don't see because it's only happening at fractions of an inch per year. So the truth is, looking at sea level rise is impossible. You can look at storm damage, you can look at erosion, you can look at flooding from rainfall and downstream flooding as it comes down the hill, right? And you can look at perhaps subsidence, which causes the land to go down so the water gets higher. Those are all things that cause flooding. Does that make sense? Okay, so we got like six flavors of flooding, if you will. The difference is that extreme tides, with the spring tides, certain days of the year, the astrologic tides even higher, which do flood streets downtown and are flooding streets in Miami. They're putting pumps in Miami Beach now, by the way. That either the predictable extreme tides or the hard-to-predict storms and events like that, or extreme rainfall events, those waters recede. Extreme tide recedes in an hour or two, right? Even a storm surge recedes in a few hours or a day, and you can rebuild. Sea level won't recede for, again, centuries, not to repeat myself. So we have to think of it differently. And the problem is that it's like that old fable of the tortoise and the hare. You know, the hare moves quickly and jumps and gets our attention and we think might win the race, but he's bouncing all over the place like storms do. And the tortoise is just creeping along and wins the race, right? Remember that fable? Well, sea level is kind of like the tortoise. It's just creeping along, and you really can't measure it. You can't see it. You can't identify it. But it keeps lifting all those other events. And when they align and happen together, it's more damage. So a lot of the models and planning you're doing here look at sea level rise plus storm surge, and that's great. But I want to get you to think bigger and farther, because I do want you to think big. I want you to be the small state that thinks big. And I want to watch this experiment over the next few years as you proceed, because I really think you're doing the right stuff. Is we can plan for the future. And even though you don't see sea level, and we don't know when we're going to get that 3 foot or 5 foot of sea level rise, but it's smart that you're planning for it. It could happen sooner rather than later. The models have a real big uncertainty in them that people don't want to talk about or don't understand. And the year 2100 is not going to be the end of the rise, by the way. So even if you get 4 feet by the year 2100, you may get 24 feet by the end of the year 2200. Now, that won't be your generation, our generation, or our kids or grandkids, but you're New Englanders. You've been in this place, in many cases, for generations, right? For centuries. And I want you to think ahead, because this isn't about what makes us the most money or makes us happiest or is easiest. This is really about building something for future generations. We are the first generation that is going to see the shoreline of this planet visibly change. Or let's say our kids and grandkids. People alive this century, those famous photographs from outer space that we all, you know, 100 years from now are going to look different. Miami might be an island, but if it's still visible. So it's a lot to think about. I know that. It's disturbing and disorienting. But let me talk to you about why I think you really do have some special opportunities here. I've already blurted out a couple. You know, you fortunately have a geography where you could actually cordon off and put locks in, not in the next 20 years, maybe in the next 80 years, but sometime in the next few centuries it'll happen. And anybody wants to bet on that, I'd be willing to make the bet, but we have to be there to collect, okay? We don't know how quickly it'll rise. There's a fallacy that the models are so good that we know when. In fact, the models have an inherent bias to underproject, and it's pretty significant. It's something that a lot of people don't want to talk about because it sounds like we might be exaggerating. But the latest IPCC, which is the big every 5 or 6 year effort you may have heard of that looks at climate, it does a sea level rise projection. And the latest one they did last year talked about up to 32 inches of sea level rise this century. The problem is if you have to read the fine print to understand that they exclude a couple of uncertainties, which are huge. And that's just fact. It's an unfortunate thing. But the way you're looking at things, looking at severe storms in the next 25 years, 50 years, and so on, sea level rise of 1 feet, 3 feet, 5 feet as models is getting you to the right place. And you don't have to plan for it all up front. You don't have to design today for 5 feet of sea level rise. But here's the thing. If you know where things are headed, you can plan better. You can build a 10-story building a floor at a time if you put in the right foundation, right? We all know that. If you build a 1-story building and decide you need the second floor and the foundation's not inadequate, you've got to do some expensive retrofits or scrap it, right? So when those of you in the business community, and that's many of you in this audience tonight, start thinking about this, and this is a really big challenge. And it doesn't require you to change what you're doing tomorrow. In fact, I suggest that you think of 3 timescales. Think of the short term. If you can see where the storm patterns are headed and know that sea level is rising, the next time you look to change your windows or doors or thresholds, or if you get a chance to renovate something, consider that. And then as you're doing here with the state agencies and the Sea Grant Program, the Coastal Resources Center and the CRMC, and I hope I get all the different initials right, the DEM and so on, that you're willing to look at the 20 and 30 year plan. And if people say, well, you know, by the end of this century, we could get 5 feet of sea level rise and possibly more, that you're respectful of that. Because it may be that the way to get the best return on investment, the best economic return in the long term, is to think longer. You know, we benefit from a lot of things that were done 100 years ago here. If you think about it, infrastructure, canals, bridges in some cases, ports certainly, well systems, cathedrals, churches, right? Many of them over 100 years old. This is really a challenge for us to do what I call cathedral thinking. That we may be building something knowing that we are not going to be there to enjoy the benefits. Now, what if you say, well, geez, this is really dark and sad and depressing, and I'm just going to move to Colorado. Well, that's fine, but the people in Colorado get their goods through ports. No one on the planet today can escape our coastal economy. You have a rich coastal economy. You have a good port, or actually two of them, I believe. You have obviously an incredible recreational sailing and boating base here, fishing. This is the ocean state. I think it's the highest proportion of coastline to land of any state. And the rich tradition going back nearly four centuries or probably longer than that. You're very vulnerable because of the extensiveness of Narragansett Bay and the funneling effect that it does make the tide surge worse up by the time it gets to Providence, and you have that hurricane barrier up there. But turn that smallness and that vulnerability into an asset. You can do things here that California can't, that Miami, that Florida can't, stuck out there in the middle of the Atlantic like a big thumb with porous limestone and just a couple of feet above sea level. You have the ability and your agencies here that work together between universities, academia, government, and the private sector. The fact that you're here tonight on a nasty night, I mean, you must be motivated to be here. It's not because of me, but you're concerned about this subject. The fact that you're that interested and you have that kind of tripartisan, if you will, the science and academia, the public sector, the municipal, state, and counties, I guess, and then the businesses is really wonderful. Not many communities do that yet on this issue. This is the biggest change in this planet. I mean, you could argue lots of other things are the biggest change, I guess. I always hate those kind of contests. But this is the only change that's going to change the shoreline, that's going to reduce the amount of land. You know that old axiom, buy land, they're not making any more of it. We all heard that growing up probably, right? Well, there, whoever they are, is about to start taking it away. Right? It's really profound. And it can be depressing, but here's the thing. You don't give up here very easily. You get through tough winters. Going back to Pilgrim days, we prepared for the winter. We prepared for the years ahead. And we're frugal. And that attitude of being willing to plan ahead is really good and is going to stand you well. Because the people who just party and just want to enjoy it and not invest in the future are going to suffer. And I think you could actually make a reputation here. You know, that the ocean state rising with the tides or rise. You know, there's several ways you could actually turn that vulnerability into an advantage. Let the world know that tiny Rhode Island, the ocean state, sees the future and is planning for it, which you are doing. I'm not telling you that. But this is a new reality, and don't confuse adapting to rising sea level with slowing the warming and the energy efficiency and greenhouse gas and all those very important things, or other environmental things like recycling. I recycle every day. Recycling will do nothing to slow sea level, nothing. It conserves goods, materials like paper, wood, glass, and things like that. It is not energy efficient. And the way we produce energy is what's warming the planet. So the problem with climate is based upon the greenhouse gases. So there are several kinds of environmental, sustainable, and green activities we do. Putting them all in one bucket is actually creating misinformation. And a lot of us do that. And I hope you join me in sharing that. Because we need to do two things. And they're remarkably simple or complex, depending on how you want to think of it. People say, well, what should we do with the ocean rising? I say, better get out of the way. You better elevate the buildings, build higher seawalls, make sure that the seawall heights are uniform so that there's not a low spot, because that's what's going to flood the back community. At some point, maybe migrate off the lowlands, the marshlands. But the good news here is, while this thing is this creeping change that is hard to see, and therefore we tend to be on the lookout for the storm surge and things like that, but this creeping, the tortoise effect, the creeping sea level rise, gives us plenty of time to adapt. We have decades to adapt. You know, with storms, tsunamis, earthquakes, and tornadoes and things like that, it may or may not hit any one place. We still plan for it. Sea level is guaranteed to rise. And it's guaranteed to rise 1 foot, 2 foot, and I could keep going up to 20 or 30. That's a scary idea. But it's not going to happen in our lifetimes. But we should do the right planning and adaptation planning and really be creative. And you have the expertise to do it here so that our grandkids and beyond will benefit from it. And I think in the short term, your state can benefit from it too. I think it can actually be a rejuvenating opportunity. I said earlier, the glass half empty or half full. Certainly there's a glass half empty here. We have a problem with sea level rise. You have a problem here around Narragansett Bay and even out on the shoreline. There's no doubt that's the glass half empty. That's the problem. But here's the way I think of the glass half full. Hopefully it's a positive spin, and I'll admit that. It's the way I end my book, and I thought about this for years. I have a young daughter who will be 14 this month, and like many of you have young kids or grandkids, and we have to say, what's going to get us through this, just like any other crisis? And here's my answer. Is one I just alluded to is this is a slow problem, and it's now unavoidable. That's a good kind of problem to prepare for. Not a possibility, and not something that could hit me tomorrow. We do those all the time, prepare for possibilities that may or may not happen, and we don't know when, right? Big storms. Category, you know, nor'easters, like hopefully going to not hit us too badly in the next few days. But we have decades to plan for this adaptation. That's a blessing. Two is once we focus on a problem and stop playing politics and denial and delay and delusion and all the other dumb stuff that we're doing, not here, but nationwide and in Congress. The sooner we focus on the problem, we're going to come up with some really creative engineering and architectural solutions. No doubt in my mind. Now, we're not going to force the ocean downward. We're not going to make the ice sheets freeze. That's not possible. But we'll come up with some very clever adaptation solutions once we focus on it, just like we do with AIDS or cell phone technology or putting a man on the moon or all the other things we're just incredibly creative at. But right now, we're arguing whether it's real. We're arguing whether we've impacted climate. Of course we have. So first is it's slow and we can plan on it. It's in the pipeline. Two is we can stand up to this challenge as we have as Americans and citizens of this planet and as New Englanders, Rhode Islanders. And the third is the opportunity for all of us is to share this. If you see a different reality than your neighbors and your friends and your business partners, you have an obligation, opportunity to share it, which is what I'm doing. And I think that every one of you is able to do that. It is a new reality, and it's the glass half empty or half full. I hope you join with me in that this is daunting stuff, but you're not typically people who shirk from stuff. You came out on a night like tonight. I know you have some flint in you. So I could talk for a long time. Sometimes I do 20-minute programs. Sometimes I do 4-hour, 6-hour programs. So I think I'm going to shut up here and take questions. I'm supposed to be off by 7. So I think there's some microphones. But thank you for your rapt attention. And let's have some interesting questions. And if you refute anything I say, hands up. I welcome it. I've been on Fox Business Channel confronting some of the paid climate deniers. I welcome it. I love just really clarifying And I've not failed yet. In 2 years, I have not been stumped by a question to where the majority of people would say that makes sense. So, yes. Okay. I'll repeat the question.
Puzzled by how that, how is that tied into what you said?
Sure. Over thousands of years, there are several changes. Geologically, as the continents literally move, they've made some big changes, but that's not that answer. But in certain places, straits have changed, where lakes have become, seas have become lakes, and vice versa, where lakes have become connected to the ocean, as geology has changed, as we've had earthquakes or tectonic forces. That's one. Two is one of the big changes I alluded to and didn't really follow through on it was that sea level's half the equation. Well, I actually probably need to back up and explain that. But land subsidence or uplift is the other half. And, for example, Norfolk, Virginia has had 30 inches of sea level rise in the last century. You've probably had less than 10, right? You've probably had about the global average, about 8 inches or so, right? You've had a little subsidence here, I think, but not much. But places, Jakarta's had 14 feet of subsidence and therefore 14 feet of sea level rise in the last 30 years. So different places, for different reasons, the land goes down or up, and that's another big change. So all sea level is not equal. I should have, in the facts I was throwing out in the beginning, I should have clarified. The melting polar ice cap doesn't affect sea level. Some of you probably know that. It's floating sea ice, like ice cubes in a glass, has no impact. Just as the growing ice around East Antarctica, floating sea ice has no impact on sea level. Sea level comes from two things. As the ocean warms, it expands, like most materials, has a very, parts don't fit in the wintertime up here, right, when they get cold. Sea level, we've had about 4 inches of sea level rise from thermal expansion of seawater as the oceans have warmed. The other half so far has come from melting of glaciers and the two ice sheets on land, Greenland and Antarctica. As that ice melts on land and runs to the ocean or breaks off into an iceberg and falls into the ocean, that raises sea level. So looking ahead, that's where it's going to come from. The thermal expansion will continue. We can project that. But it's the melting of, and here's the kicker, that all the glaciers in the world, when they melt, will add 3 feet of sea level from Alaska to the Alps. Hard to believe, but that's all. Greenland will add 24 feet when it melts entirely. Antarctica, 186 feet when it melts entirely. Added up, 212 feet of sea level rise is potential. Now, it can't happen centuries from now. It probably can't happen for thousands of years. But 10 feet of sea level rise is a disaster. We're trying to plan for 1, 3, and 5. So my point, and I'll let another question here, but is you're going to hear more about storm modeling and sea level. They're really very different dynamics and timescales and magnitudes. You've got to be able to add them together, and then you've got to be able to think of them separately, because one's the hare and one's the tortoise.
Yeah, you have sketched some rather extensive and daunting challenges here. But the question I have is, we can't find the resources today to repair our roads. Where would you care to speculate on how we might end up with enough resources? And I suppose that's political will. This is inherently a political question to actually address these things.
It's a great question. Of course, I don't have any knowledge locally, but you've hit on the answer. It's political will and its priorities. And somehow, in every jurisdiction that's threatened, we're going to have to rethink some priorities. And whether that's federal money, whether that's state, whether it's local, whether it's personal, whether it's diverting something from something else that's presently a high priority, the ocean doesn't care what we think. The ocean doesn't care when you budget to build the seawall higher. The ice doesn't care whether you're Republican or Democrat. It's going to melt at 32 degrees, right? I mean, I say that tongue-in-cheek, obviously, but the truth is, if the sea's rising, you're either going to lose infrastructure and buildings into the surf, or you're going to have decided that maybe that's more important than some other priority. And investing in the future, I think, can be a good rationale. And the bankers are going to have to look at this too, because financing buildings for 30 and 50 years when maybe the collateral won't be there is a problem too. So this is really profound. It's not just like another roadworks project, and I don't mean to be dismissive of your example. We are going to really have to rethink. Some places are not savable. So I hope that answers that. But I don't have that answer for you. There's something. Yeah.
If the sea level rises 20 feet, what will that mean to the harborfront in Newport Harbor? It won't be 20 feet, will it?
Well, you know, again, there. I think you'll hear from much better expertise than me in terms of what it means for Newport Harbor. But again, every harbor in the world will be underwater at 20 feet. I can tell you that. The challenge is this. Is if it happens over 200 years and you plan for it and you start building your waterfront up, you'll adapt. The storm surge, which could be 25 feet by Friday, possibly, right? Possibly, or next, certainly by next week. Storm surge of 25 feet, you're planning to be resilient to. Sea level rise, which will not recede, is a different problem, but there's a much longer time to prepare for it.
I guess what I'm really asking is that sea level rise of 20 feet is not going to be uniform around the planet.
Okay, good question.
Or 2,000 feet if you want. I don't care what the number
is. I'm sorry?
Or 2,000 feet. I don't care what the number is.
No. Well, no. If all the ice on the planet melts, you get 200 feet of sea level rise. So that's the maximum. And let's hope that's 3,000 years, not 300 years. Okay? Fair enough to start. But regardless, if we get 5 feet by the end of this century and 25 feet next century, which is very possible. We don't know, but it's very possible. What's the variation? There are places like Jakarta, Tokyo, New Orleans, and Norfolk that are going to be worse than average. Alaska is actually uplifting faster than sea level, so Alaska has sea level dropping. Not because of Sarah Palin. It's actually physically going down. It's not a political position. Sorry. So I hope that answers it. It's not uniform, but it all has to do with that land uplift or subsidence, which is within a range.
So can you, as you've done your book tour and you've talked, I wonder if you could characterize the reaction you get. Just the focus of this symposium is going to probably arguably attract folks who are probably sympathetic to your point of view. But you mentioned earlier that this is ultimately a question of political will in terms of whether or not communities rise to the challenge. And I wonder if you could characterize the response that you've received and is it in direct relationship to the peril. Do people in South Florida get this because they don't have a choice?
Okay, I got your question. No, there's cultural attitudes in different places that make people more open, I think. And it's somewhat of a political attitudinal thing. I mean, I think up here in New England, you again have a very practical, pragmatic take on things. I was nervous about wearing a tie to this meeting. You know, just I know you're just kind of down to earth here. And you deal with the waterfront. The waterfront's always been part of your history here. And the waterfront's always been dynamic and stormy and both an opportunity to make money and to lose money, if you will. I mean, it's a vulnerable spot, but critical. And I guess I skipped over that one of the reasons that not only shouldn't you consider leaving this place, the world's going to need ports. We're all going to want coastal property still. Even if for the next 300 years the coastline keeps moving inland, it's going to make it challenging. We're going to have to think differently about the coastline, about how we develop it. There are some places we will elevate. Some places we will retreat. Some places we will put barricades where we keep the water at the current level. We have to put our mindset. There's opportunities to be made there in those engineering and designs and construction projects. They're bigger and bolder than probably what you've been thinking. Therein lies a great opportunity. I really believe that 100 years from now, the communities that will be doing well, the coastal communities, will be those that thought big, that designed for the future, and saw that this is really as simple as ice melting. We just, our 5,000 years of human civilization, more or less, was a period of stable sea level. We got fooled into thinking that was forever. We arrived at slack tide. Right? You know, you stand at the inlet, and if you just show up at slack tide, Water doesn't change. It just swirls around, right? Half hour later, it's on its way out or up. Yes.
Do you see coastal adaptation, including cities underwater?
Okay. Great questions. The inland part is a little complicated. As the ocean's warm, there's more moisture in there. It's going to come down as heavier rainfall patterns, which is what we're seeing. But that doesn't mean there aren't going to be places that won't have droughts, like California's been having, for example, or the Southwest in America. But more moisture in there will come down as more rain. Some places that will fill lakes higher, but the warmer temperature causes more evaporation. So there's a dynamic going on, and it has to do with air currents, temperature, humidity levels, and rainfall. And so whether lakes inland get higher or lower is not a simple extrapolation. And it's going to change from place to place. Cities underwater. No. Sure, we'll have a couple of cities underwater. There's three people living in Florida underwater in a Habitat for Science now, or, you know, we could put 12 people on the moon maybe and have a million people supporting them, you know, on Earth. So it's not a realistic solution to anything. We have to figure out how to take the 7 billion or 10 billion people we're going to have and live here with a moving coastline in changing weather patterns and feed them and give them water. And rising oceans will intrude on freshwater tables in places like Florida and maybe here too. So we have a lot to work on. But again, you know, we got two choices. We can give up and throw in the towel and just move to Denver. But that's not going to solve the problem. And you know that. And the truth is, I really believe that with your smallness here, with your ability to work together, your long, long, long history of coping with a challenging maritime economy and environment, you're as well suited as any place to adapt. And you can be the ports and ocean recreation and fishing grounds of the future if you plan. I'm not admonishing you to do something you're not already doing. I'm just asking you to think of it differently and step back, even one more step than people here have already been doing. I'm really just trying to reinforce what they've done. I'm not trying to correct anything. So I think we got time for maybe two or three more questions. I guess 7 o'clock was our cutoff time. Yes.
Most of our fresh water supply is at sea level, at least on the island. We can lose a lot of infrastructure, but if we lose our fresh water supply due to rising sea levels, the island becomes uninhabitable. Is anybody considering that?
I don't know what they're doing locally, but I do know this, that I think that, you know, I think in the next 30 or 40 years, my personal belief is that technology will allow us to make electricity without putting carbon dioxide up in the air. I don't think, with solar, wind, and some other maybe different nuclear, but solar primarily, we're going to do some pretty neat stuff. Between that and some new technologies to desalinate water, I think making fresh water is not going to be the challenge over the next, by mid-century. I can't tell you how to get there, okay, but I think you're right, but I think in the long term, fresh water is not going to be the problem. I think between solar and some creative freshwater production things, that will be dealt with, is my guess. But in the meantime, in the first couple of decades, it may be a real problem because we already have people, a billion people that don't get adequate fresh water on the planet.
I'm thinking of Holland.
Yeah.
And what they have done in their country over a few centuries, if I can believe history. Do we have anything to learn from them? Would it be beneficial to collaborate, or are they too far ahead of us?
No, it's a great question. I was there 2 weeks last year and on some study groups and did some presentations, and so I'm pretty comfortable with characterizing them. The Dutch have been reclaiming land for 1,000 years from the ocean. They're on a delta. It's like kind of the mouth of the Mississippi, if you will. It's soft land, and it was compacting and rich soil because of that, and to make real estate, they would create levees, which have a lot of clay in them, and they can pump the water out with windmills back then, obviously, and make real estate, okay, and they've gotten really good at that. Their technology about predicting floods from rainfall and North Sea storms, the equivalent of your nor'easters, is really good. They're really advanced. And the other element over there that they got really good at was a tragedy on February 1st, 1953, overnight, killed 1,835 people overnight because a dike broke, a levee broke, and a whole portion of the country in the middle of the night literally went underwater, and 1,835 people. That was kind of their September 11th moment. They woke up and said, never again. You know, we're going to engineer our way around this. And they did a great job. But here's an interesting example that you've probably seen those big gates at Rotterdam Harbor, you know, those two semicircular gates, the what they call Maslon Caring, the two big gates that protect Rotterdam Harbor from extreme rainfall events or North Sea storms. When they were designing those, and they cost $1 billion roughly, U.S., those just those two gates as part of their defense system that they built in the last 50 years, they allowed for a foot of sea level rise. Because when they designed them in the 1970s, that was all they could anticipate. So now they know that the design, and they were planning for a 1 in 10,000 year storm as a design criteria. It was a mismatch. They had no idea you could melt the ice sheets this quickly. Nobody did in the 1970s. It's really only been in the last decade that we had any idea we could possibly melt the ice sheets this quickly. The Arctic will be ice-free in our lifetimes for many of us. That's amazing. It's been frozen for 3 million years. So we're in a different world. Now, the Dutch have done a great job, but and we can learn some things from them. But and I don't want to dismiss anything. They have some really good engineering technology, but engineering companies today are global. I mean, they're selling a lot of stuff as almost an export industry. I think we'll come up with our own ways to adapt. Knowledge isn't national anymore. You can be, you know, a small group of really bright people anywhere on the planet and sell that expertise today. You could develop your own expertise. You could not only develop expertise to adapt to rising sea level in this kind of an environment, you could create a sea level institute. I talked to some people here today about that. People have been asking me, you know, where do I go after my book and my kind of speaking and consulting? I mean, I think we need, just like you have coastal institutes, I think we need a sea level institute so that there's a world center for knowledge and being able to explain and teach engineers and architects. I mean, there's a lot of ways you could turn this into your own export center, if you will, or import of revenue, people coming here. People go from all over the world to study the Dutch, as you said, but they don't have all the answers. And their answers don't apply to Florida at all, actually. Florida's been spending a lot of money bringing the Dutch over, and their answers just don't apply because we have porous limestone, and it's like 3 feet above sea level. They don't have that. We can't build a seawall and pump the water out like they can. So different places are different solutions, and there's no reason that this should not continue your progress as a thought leadership center here in New England. And if I can help you with that, I would be glad to, by the way.
So you mentioned pumping, and that has become the short-term soup du jour for a lot of places. You can think New Orleans or Rotterdam or wherever you want. I got to ask, where is Miami planning on pumping to?
That's a great question. The mayor of Miami Beach and I were on the program last Wednesday together, and he read my book, and he's tweeted to every, he stood in front of this room of 400 business people. He said, buy John's book. So I mean, literally that way. But he said to me as we were sitting there at the dais, he said, you know, I know that the pumps are just the first phase. They don't win the war. It's the first battle. This is a very, very, very long war. We're just doing what we need to keep the streets drivable year-round while we figure out some other solutions. And he's right. One more question, and I'm going to be around signing books when this is over. And for those of you here tomorrow morning, I'm going to actually show some graphics and things like that. And my website's got a lot of free information on it besides the book, which you may buy.
Thank you very much for your presentation. My question, we spoke earlier about the lack of political will or lack of public will behind that. And you said you've met Jacques Cousteau, and you ran the Cousteau Society, and of course he was responsible for creating this great increase in awareness about our oceans. What are some of the most creative, inspirational, effective strategies or things that we could do to galvanize the public to take action, the kind of far-looking thinking action that we need to take to prepare for this imminent?
What do I have, 30 seconds for that answer? It's a great question. I don't have a simple answer, but I do believe this. I really believe that, like most things, that knowledge is power. There's no benefit in shirking from the facts, okay? And a lot of the things I've thrown at you tonight are a little bit new information. A lot of people have always assumed that if we just do the environmental and green things, that climate change will take care of itself or sea level will stop, okay? I've changed your reality now. And when people say, well, we don't want to tell people not to do recycling. Well, no, I think recycling, I recycle every day. It's going to have no effect on climate change. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. We should do it for other reasons, okay? So I guess part of the answer is let's start with good facts and not add to the confusion. So the instance says, what are you doing for climate change? You say, well, I'm going to go home and do more recycling, which people have told me. Experts have told me that. And I said, really? And their face said, yeah, it's not true, is it? Yeah. I said, no, it's not true. So I honestly think that the first thing to do, like any problem, whether it be a personal relations problem, a financial problem, an engineering problem, you know, a business problem, or any other problem, is let's get the facts right. And hardly anybody understands the facts of this problem. You really, I mean, I travel around the world explaining this stuff. I'm gratified at how people get it, no matter what their technical scientific background. And you can educate others. And I really believe that. We all have to do a mind shift. The shoreline is no longer the shoreline. It was the shoreline for the last few thousand years. Storm surge is a short-term problem and a real one. But sea level is a different problem. And you now can distinguish the two. See, the magnitude's different, the certainty, the resiliency factor, that some recede, some don't, et cetera. That new reality is the first step to figuring this out collectively. Thank you very much.